Tonight on Arena, Emer McBride on her new novel, The City Changes Its Face, and Bridget Jones' Mad About the Boy and Captain America are the movies up for review. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. First this evening, many of you will have been following the unfolding story at the Arts Council. Taoiseach Simon Harris today said that it was alarming that the Arts Council ignored the public spending code when €7 million was allocated to an unsuccessful IT system. The project was ultimately shelved. An external review of the governance and culture at the Arts Council has been ordered by Minister Patrick O'Donovan, who told our colleagues on Morning Ireland earlier today that he was, quote, desperately angry about the waste of public funds. I'm joined this evening by RTE's arts and media correspondent, Evelyn O'Rourke, who has the latest on this running story. Evelyn, remind us, first of all, what exactly was revealed yesterday?
Okay, feels like a long time ago now in the story, so much has happened since, but really all this kicked off yesterday when Minister for the Arts, he's only newly appointed to this department, but Minister for the Arts, Patrick O'Donovan, brought the rather delayed annual report for the Arts Council for 2023, remember, to Cabinet yesterday morning. So this is really the first that people knew about it, because it confirmed and revealed that money had been lost on an unsuccessful IT system development project. Now the numbers for some are kind of eye-watering. At this point, the report noted an overall loss of value in respect of that project estimated at 5.3 million, and that went on until June 2024. But the total cost of the project to date is 6.6 million. Just the little gap there between the five and the six figure, that's monies that have yet to be handed over, that the Arts Council say that they'd actually held back because they weren't happy with the work. And the Arts Council will keep pointing to their report and saying, look, in it, we are convinced that we can carry on legal redress here. We're going to pursue the companies legally. And they think that they can claw more money back. That's not washing its face really with the political sector, who are saying and talking about this figure, 7 million. So that's to explain the numbers involved here.
And the political sector had their say today. Well, politicians certainly had their say today in the Dáil. What kind of reaction did we get?
Yes, it was Leaders' Question Time at 12 o'clock today, and Labour used its time to really raise this issue. And I mean, just looking at some of the phrases I noted while watching proceedings, shambolic was one of the phrases from Labour. Then Padraig Tobin from Aonth, who stood up, and he talked about the Arts Council, that they had incinerated €7 million of public money. So very, very strong words here. In Ivana Bacik's case for Labour, she was saying and recommending that she wanted the Dáil to debate it. Simon Harris had Taoiseach responding, agreeing and saying he had no problem with that. He stood up with a sheaf of papers, actually, and he said, look, I've page after page, spreadsheet after spreadsheet, and nothing to show for it. So really very, very strong words and condemnation today, really, in the Dáil.
And who was being blamed?
Well, I think it's mixed now. I mean, yesterday morning it was about the Arts Council report, right? But immediately attention was drawn to the department as such, this Department of Arts that Catherine Martin led, obviously, until the election, and now obviously that Patrick O'Donovan has inherited. He himself has now said that he has ordered a review internally of his department. So as I sit opposite you this evening, and I mean the story keeps moving on, we have the wider review into the Arts Council. So it's not just about this one issue. He's now ordered this external review into the overall corporate and governance at the Arts Council. So that's a broader brief maybe than would have been expected. He also now has his own internal review into what happened in the department. And then obviously we have the paperwork. If you go back over it, the Arts Council would say, look, we've explained all the factors, we've given all the, you know, the insights into what happened and how this escalated. And it seems from one of those things that started off with a project that was going to be around two and a half million, things went wrong. They broadened the brief, contracts were changed, and it was almost like people got dug into a hole and it just kept going.
What kind of reaction has there been from artists and the arts community?
Today they've started to come out, I think, a bit stunned. I think the head has been spinning a little bit about this. And I suppose the concern for this community and the sector, they're described, you know, as precarious, for example. And I myself spoke to Maria Fleming. She's the chair of the National Campaign for the Arts. And they're talking about the fact that they are worried about the long-term consequences about this, because obviously so many people in the arts rely on funding, right? And the big thing is the basic income for the arts, that project is so important.
Which Minister Catherine Martin had succeeded in having a pilot scheme. And
yes,
that's under review at the moment.
It is. So what they'd done is they'd set it in place that it could run on for some time. But in the programme for government, the commitment is to review it. It's not to keep running it. So it'd be very much in Minister Patrick O'Donovan's work.
I should have said former Minister Catherine Martin.
Yeah, so she sort of started or rolled it out as such. But it's very much in his, you know, world now, what happens next. And I suppose it's only fair, it's only reasonable to think that artists are going to be worried that are they somehow going to suffer some sort of consequences about this entire incident.
Because much has been said in recent times about the increase in funding in recent years to the Arts Council, and that has been praised and wonderfully welcomed by artists.
Oh, when you look back over the figures, it's astonishing. I mean, at the last budget, they came in at 140 million. Now, interestingly, that was a massive growth over the previous period. At the time in October, there was disappointment from the Arts Council. They had been advocating passionately for a rise to 150 million, and some journalists were surprised that maybe they hadn't got that 150 million in October. But they are at 140 million, and it's considered, you know, big money, big funding. I was talking myself to Heather Humphreys today, a previous Minister for the Arts, and she said, look, it's an independent agency. They take their money, they manage it. So lots of different voices coming in on this now, and so many questions, so many more questions than answers.
Well, and that's my final question. What happens next? What are the next steps? This external review obviously is going to be the first major thing. Are there other things in the pipeline that have been spoken about?
Yeah, we need to see the terms of reference for that. But I suppose the big gap at the moment are the committees, and that was raised today. Like, at this point in time, there isn't a PAC, there isn't a media Oireachtas Media and Arts Committee, for example, because we're so used to that in recent years, people having to immediately appear in front of these committees. There is that gap there, and Padraig Tobin raised this today as well. Those committees will not be set up for a couple of more weeks as such. So I suppose once they get up and running as well, they'll be looking back over it and looking for answers too.
And have the Arts Council said much themselves about it?
At this point, they haven't provided us with a spokesperson today. They, I think, would just keep pointing to their statement in their report and saying that it's all there, that they feel they've really addressed so many of the issues, and that they feel very keen on this point, that they are involved in the legal situation, that they are doing their best to claw back money. And they say that they take their position of being custodians of public money very, very seriously. And they really think that they will have some case there.
Thanks very much for coming into us this evening, Evelyn. That's Evelyn O'Rourke, RTE's arts and media correspondent. And so to tonight's film reviews, and with me in studio at this stage, Donald Clark. And Sabrina, I always get this name wrong. Sabrina, I'm going to call you all of it, all of
do
those.
Do whatever
things.
You like, Sean.
Serena Bellissimo. Bridget is back, so is Captain America. Double Oscar winner Renée Zellweger returns in Bridget Jones, Mad About the Boy, fourth Bridget installment. Thankfully, the travails of her love life are as fascinating as ever, accompanied this time, though, by a bittersweet note of grief. And we're back in the Marvel Cinematic Universe for a reboot. Many times have I said that in the last couple of years. Captain America, Brave New World, Anthony Mackie taking over from Chris Evans as the new Captain America, Donald Clark, and Serena Bellissimo with me in studio this evening. And, of course, Bridget Jones, Mad About the Boy. Where else would you start? I was looking at some of the dates. Is it 2001 was the very first one?
Yeah, 2001, 2001. Yeah. That's right. It was either that one or two. Yeah.
Yeah. So like 25 years, and whatever. This is film number four, I think. Where are we in the world of the cozy rom-com, Donald Clark?
Interesting film. This in that they make such comfortable amounts of money in Britain and Ireland and Australia that they didn't really have to work very hard at getting that, so opening the wallets of people who are fans of Bridget Jones. But they've made a proper film. They've actually gone back and they've got a really good director in Michael Morris, who made a fine film called For Leslie recently, and made a proper film. Where is she? It's giving nothing away because this happens before the credits. That interestingly, the book that this was based on was actually published before Bridget Jones's Baby, the last
one. Which was the last film.
And they must have clearly decided we can't quite kill off Mark Darcy yet. We've got one more go round.
Colin Firth character,
Colin Firth character. Anyway, he's dead now, and he's dead in the first few seconds, so don't worry, I'm giving nothing away. And that opening section, before you get to the credits, is actually very touching. Meditation on grief, which sounds very pompous of me, but it genuinely is.
Well, I suppose they were 30 somethings back in the 2001 film, so here they are at
middle aged figures, and he accompanies her to down the road, and he goes to the old pals for the anniversary of his death, and they open the door and he's gone, because obviously he's gone.
Yeah.
And she's persuaded to kind of grasp hold of her life again and go out and get a job. Right, and she goes out and gets a job. And then somewhere down the line, she meets up with a much younger man, played by Leo Woodall, who was one day last year.
We'll come back to the younger aspect of the story in the midst of all of that. But as Donald describes it there, Serena, that idea of the kind of the Mark Darcy character walking with her down the street, and we know he's dead. And then that is very touching. So they set a note that, yes, you will get your laughs here, but we're looking at something else here too.
And that's what I love. And it's not just all grief, because grief in itself is up and down. Mm. You have your laughs, you have your sad times, you see a bit of everything. And I love, like, I am such a skeptic, Sean, when it comes to sequels. I'm like, do we really need another one? Yes, to Bridget Jones. We needed this one. I think we needed this one because this is the perfect way to say goodbye to Bridget. And it's not just like, most people I spoke to did get teary or did get emotional watching this. And it wasn't just about Mark Darcy. Like, there's a scene in there, and I don't know if it's because I'm missing my mates back home, but there's a scene in there where when we talk about Bridget Jones, love isn't just about the opposite sex. It's about your chosen family, those
friends, all of that.
And there is a beautiful New Year's Eve scene where I just started finding myself sobbing.
Well, I think because we've lived with these characters for so long, depending what age you are, but if you are if you saw it in
2001,
exactly.
If it was a date movie for you back then,
the first one 20 years ago, or even and the book is 30 years old. The column is 30 years old this year that evolved into the book. You're kind of mourning a little bit for your own life and for the people you've lost and people
along
you no longer see and all those things. But we should say that as well as making it sound like a Bergman film, which it most certainly is not, it is still very funny and very fresh. But I think that I really admire them that they've gone back and they've removed actually a lot of the things that used to irritate me about this series. That there's not so much of Bridget Jones falling over. We've quite enough of her falling over in the first
film. Yes.
They've toned down the chattering friends a bit. They're also a little bit grating to my mind. And they've gone for a more sincere grasp of emotion.
And now Uncle Daniel, Hugh Grant, is in total sincere
mood
and just a great pal. You know, it's all the difficulties of the past have been put to sleep, and he is really, really helpful.
Do you know what? He's still Daniel as well. He's still got that cheeky side.
Yeah.
Watching this, I just went, more Hugh Grant doing this, please.
Well,
because Hugh Grant is brilliant. And the chemistry between him and Renee is off the charts.
Well, let's listen to a moment. See, she's heading out. She needs a babysitter. Sure, who else would she be getting other than Uncle Daniel to do the job for her?
Uncle Daniel!
Miniature Darcy, what's the news?
Where are the ladies with the big
hair? They couldn't make it, sadly. They're washing their hair.
All three?
Yeah, well, they wash each other's, you see.
I thought you said no more models.
Geminita is not a model, Jones. She is a poet and a healer and a model. Come here. Hell of a night for you.
Ugh, I can't go. The children need me.
Uncle Daniel!
You, right. Get a fork and some syrup. I'm going to style you.
I found the cards.
Very good. Excellent. Now then, we need to work on your bluffing and your cheating.
Ah, that's the babysitter you need. Even he was a cad back
it's
in the
funny,
day.
I think watching that, when I watched the first one, it did strike me that it's a little bit like the habit the sitcoms have and soap operas have, eventually coming round to the antagonist, that like Mrs. Mangle in Neighbours or Margaret in MASH, that towards the end, after kind of like years living with these, they eventually come round to them and warm to them. They become like, likeable rogues or likeable nuisances rather than actual the Machiavellian characters they once were.
Yeah, it did strike me that when I saw Bridget Jones Mad About the Boy, I thought, oh, we're going to get the older Bridget Jones, the toy boy story.
Which is a relatively small part of the film, isn't it?
Yeah. That's the Leo Woodall.
Yeah.
The Leo Woodall character. But it's clever how it plays with, the grief at the loss of Darcy, the miniature Darcy, lovely line in the midst of that previous clip. The grief at the loss of Darcy, and then how other men start to come into her life and be involved with her.
Yeah, no, I love. Before I talk about that, can we talk about all the hat tips as well to the original? Donald and I were saying outside that this is great because this could have gone down the road of let's do all these hat tips. Let's, like, they were aware of moments like Daniel was supposed to have died. Yeah. Right. And so there's a thing hanging up in her.
Grand plan him, you don't kill him off.
Exactly. But like there's a thing hanging up in the house going, you know, Daniel, playboy found dead. So like there's these constant winks to the audience, but without going overboard. And then the way they introduce the Leo Woodall character and the Chewy Tail Edgefall character, it is all just seamless.
Yeah, so Leo Woodall is a warden in the local park.
Yes.
He literally rescues her from a tree.
We're going to hear a clip giving us just that. And the Chewy Tail Edgefall character, he's a science teacher.
He is.
In the kids' school. So here, I think initially it's Renée Zellweger talking to Chewy Tail Edgefall, and then Daniel Woodall comes along to help her.
Everything all right, Mrs. Darcy?
Yep, super. Just climbing a tree.
I can see that. Having fun?
Yes, it was really fun.
You sure you don't need a hand?
No, no. As Einstein said, what goes up must come down.
Newton.
Yes, Newton.
We're going to die!
No, we're not going to die. We're having fun.
We are definitely going to die.
Clearly, you've got this nicely in hand.
Look, there's a policeman.
Oh, my God. I've climbed a magical man tree.
And there you go. I suppose that's classic Bridget Jones, isn't it? The voiceover, the diary writing.
I would say one observation that, funny, I went back and I was just doing some notes on the review to listen to. What I was checking up on was the opening sequence of the very first film, because there's a gag in here, a very good gag, which relates back to that, which I won't spoil. But one thing was nagging about me about her accent in this is that, has her accent changed? And it has.
It's a bit posher, for sure.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's got Potter. Now, it's still extremely good. She still does a completely convincing English accent, but actually it's a convincing different English accent, I would argue, is the one that she had in the first film. It's interesting, this, oddly, this is going straight to streaming in the US, which demonstrates a real difference between the popularity of this film series or how it ended up here and in other Anglophone territories. Bridget Jones's Baby was the highest grossing film in Ireland of all films in 2016. One of the films that beat, interestingly, was the Captain America film that year,
which we're about to talk about.
But in the US, gradually declined, so you can't go and see it in cinemas.
Well, I guess, a lot of people, it was a date movie in 2001, maybe 2006, whatever position, whatever point it comes in your relationship. You know, that's why they're releasing it this weekend, isn't it? Tomorrow being the 14th of Feb. Is it a big yes, don't miss from you, Serena?
This, especially if you're a fan, this is a huge yes. And there's a pool scene in here that is going to rival Daniel Craig's walking out of the water in his Bond film.
Oh, God, yes. Yeah.
Oh, God, you've really... And I'm going to have a few little tears, Donald, as well.
Oh, I was blubbing like an infant at the end of it. Just clarify in case, that you haven't liked them that much and found them a bit bitty. I think it's by far the best of the four films.
The
It is a proper film. It is working title, who invented that romantic comedy in the late 90s, is a classic working title film at its best.
Stars, did I get stars from you, Serena?
I'm going to give this a five.
Five.
Four and a half.
Oh, okay. I never would have thought.
Just has to have a little bit of cynicism in there. Let us move on to Captain America, which might complete up to the five. Who knows? Marvel is as partial as the next cinematic universe, obviously, to a reboot. In this iteration of Captain America Brave New World, Anthony Mackie is Sam Wilson, the new Captain America. Harrison Ford as the American
My good
president.
Friend.
Thaddeus. Yes, I believe you were speaking to him. An American president called Thaddeus Ross, who seems he may have anger issues. Now, it's very hard not to see parallels with the current present, but I believe...
Well, they don't like that. No, that I talked to Harrison Ford a few weeks back, and it's interesting that that whenever I raise this issue, I mean,
yeah,
it's not just the fact that you have this, you have a president who's a new president and ultimately ends up becoming the Red Hulk, therefore demonstrating a degree of anger that we sometimes associate with Donald Trump. It's also right at the beginning, there's all these sequence of people saying, like, you can't work with that guy is awful, and so forth. Anyway, I asked
for Ford,
he said, there, I mean, and I believe him. I mean, yeah. It is an entertainment, it is not based in any reality. Yeah. And I think the film is so clunking and is so lacking in any subtext that I do genuinely believe that actually
that
occurs to them.
Yeah. Is there any point in trying to explain the plot here at all?
I'll just do it simply, right? So the Avengers, there's a person out there who's going to take on the world. There's going to be a world war. There's mind bending involved in this. Look, I have to admit, Captain America has never been my favourite out of the Avengers. Yeah. I find Chris Evans's portrayal of him really boring, but Anthony Mackie.
Oh, does something here for you.
I thought Anthony Mackie brought a little bit of life and a pep to his step, and his sidekick, who, of course, if there's a new Captain America, there has to be a new Falcon. That's played by Danny Ramirez, who a lot of people would have seen in Maverick. He brings the humour to this. I think Bridget Jones has no concern about Captain America overtaking it at the box office. I think that this is probably, like, the way that this was done is 2 hours, which I already gave it a star because it was under 2.5 hours. But I think this would have been better served. Do you remember when they used to have, like, the cartoon series of the Avengers or of Marvel?
Yeah. This, Spider-Man.
Yeah, this would have been better served as a 30-minute animated episode of that than
well,
a 2 hour.
Well, it feels like TV. I would just correct you one thing, Sean. It's not a reboot. I mean, the point of a reboot is when you basically trash everything
yes.
and start
all right,
again from
yeah,
scratch.
Start from the beginning.
It's just a different person.
A different manifestation.
Part of the issue I had, actually, with it is that this is one of the smallest issues I have, which I thought was a completely appalling film, is that this notion that Captain America is now a job, like being Surgeon General or something.
All right.
That can be passed from one incumbent to the next. And like so someone else in this job of Captain America, which is some official role in the US Constitution now, which I didn't quite buy.
I'm not sure why I'm going to play this clip other than to let you hear 21 seconds of what generally happens in these Marvel movies, if I'm not being too cynical about it all. Captain America, Brave New World, Anthony Mackie is fighting a henchman called Copperhead, played by... Johannes Hauker Johansson. Work out the dialogue for yourself.
Not that hard. I heard your rib go. You need a minute?
Nope. Let's get this over with. I got shit to do today.
There we go. That's a clip from Captain America. I don't know how much wiser you are about it. Briefly, Harrison Ford, is it worth it for him even? Don?
No. I mean, I used to know these things before. I don't know what this is for any longer. One,
I thought it was going to be the half that you took off Bridget Jones. What do you say?
It would be neat. I can knock it down to a half so you get a neat vibe.
I'm going to do two, and I can attest to the fact that Donald hated it. I was in the same screening and
right.
I heard it.
Okay. I want to briefly mention, if I could, we spoke to the director on the programme last night, To a Land Unknown, Matthew Fleifel. This is a quite an unusual take on it happens to be a Palestinian refugee story. In some ways, it could be any refugee story. Two extraordinary performances at the centre of it, Donald.
A very impressive film. It's interesting that there's a model lurking deep in there to Midnight Cowboy.
Yeah, and he also mentioned Of Mice and Men to me last night.
That makes sense as well. Yeah. But I think, I mean, there are all kinds of things to like about this. I like the fact that it was shot pretty much on the fly in Athens. So you're going amongst the public and you get a real sense of the grit and busyness of that city. I also like the fact that it was very important and very brave in it is they do not present idealized, perfect figures, yeah. saintly figures. They are flawed. They are forced. They feel themselves forced into committing crimes to get by.
To survive.
To survive. And I think that was brave. And then nonetheless, you will obtain empathy for them despite that.
Yeah. Did you feel the same, Serena?
I completely agree. I was saying to Donald, I wish they'd show this in schools as well, because you realise that not everyone is led to a life of crime because they're bad.
Yeah. It really does look at the plight of the person who is dumped into a land unknown, expecting to go to Germany and being dropped in Greece.
And I like that this is not made by Hollywood, because if this was made in Hollywood,
it'd be a
different
film. Exactly. Stars, if that's not too crass.
I'm going to give it four.
Four.
I give it four stars too, yes.
It's a very solid four. To a land unknown. In selected cinemas nationwide, or in selected cinemas this weekend, I do believe Captain America and Bridget Jones all over the place, I would guess. Might be a good date night movie for the weekend. Serena Bellissimo and Donald Clark, thank you very much. Emma McBride's debut novel, A Girl is a Half-Formed Thing, won numerous accolades, including the Women's Prize for Fiction and the inaugural Goldsmiths Prize. Emotionally charged and formally ambitious, it set the tone for her subsequent novels, The Lesser Bohemians and Strange Hotel. McBride returns this month with a new novel, The City Changes Its Face, where she returns to Stephen and Eileen, the characters from The Lesser Bohemians, and revisits their tumultuous age gap relationship 2 years on from the events of that book. Delighted to have Emma McBride join me on the programme this evening. Maybe just for those who aren't fully familiar with The Lesser Bohemians, or indeed have read it and I think, can you just remind me of what happened there? Tell us who Stephen and Eileen were in that book, even though I know it took you a whole book to tell us that in The Lesser Bohemians, but give us a sense of who they were and what has changed in the intervening period into the novel that we have today, The City Changes Its Face.
All right, well, the condensed version, so yes. So Eileen, in The Lesser Bohemians, she's an 18-year-old drama student from Ireland who comes to London to study, and it's set in Camden in the 1990s. And she meets Stephen, who's a 38-year-old actor, and they have a one-night stand, and they don't expect to ever see each other again, but they do bump into each other and a relationship starts. Mm. And at first it's very casual, but then it becomes more, and then it becomes a whole lot more.
And so it's hardly surprising when it became a whole lot more, and, you know, things were discussed and revealed to us in The Lesser Bohemians, which people can get and read for themselves. But at what point was it, during the writing of The Lesser Bohemians or afterwards, that you thought, there's more in this pair, I have to get back to them, there's more in their story that I need to tell and to explore?
Yeah, it was quite early on, actually, in Lesser Bohemians, maybe after a first or second draft, where I suddenly realised that I wasn't done with them, that they kind of embody everything that I find really interesting to write about. They're, you know, broken people who are trying very hard to go forward with their lives. And that fascinates me. And I realised that, you know, I knew where Lesser Bohemians would finish, but that actually, there was still more in them that I wanted to explore.
And was that an exciting moment, Emma, or was it, oh Lord, these two are not going to leave me alone?
I mean, it certainly increased the sense of the workload. I hadn't realised it would be so long either, to be honest, because it's, you know, it's 9 years since The Lesser Bohemians came out. And so it's a lot of my life. They've taken up a whole lot of me.
So here we are then in The City Changes Its Face. A couple of years on, the story is kind of unfolds over a single night, but it's looking at the past 2 years over that single night. That's an interesting kind of juxtaposition already of time frames. Condense it into an evening, but you're going to tell 2 years of story in that evening.
Yeah, so it runs along the two time frames. Mm. So the main, the kind of the opening and the arc is this one rainy night in Camden Town in their flat, in which they kind of have a reckoning about what's gone wrong in the relationship. But as you say, it then tracks back and forth in memory through their conversations to all the different things that have happened over the last 2 years, the kind of the wonder of moving in together and of kind of love and intimacy, and then more difficult things where Stephen's, you know, teenage daughter, who's only a little younger than Eileen, comes back into his life, and how they all try to make that relationship work. And then there's a kind of a third element as well, which is the story of Stephen's film that he's made. He's made an autobiographical film that in The Less Bohemians he's writing, and now he's made it. And the three of them go to watch a cut of it, and and how that affects their relationships as well.
And this is part of, I mean, always when people speak of your work, and indeed when I read it myself, formerly ambitious is, you know, it's the kind of stock phrase that is in there. But sometimes when that phrase is used, you know, people kind of go, oh, Lord, what does that actually mean? What is formerly ambitious? Is it going to be difficult to read? Is it going to be, I'm not going to be able to follow the story because the narrative is going to be fragmented and told in a different way. But one of the things that really struck me, particularly in the reading of the city changes its face, yes, all of those fragmentary aspects and indeed the film script, as you say, slight version of the film script that Stephen plays out for his daughter and for Eily, is there as well. How much do you think of the reader in all of that? Because for this reader, certainly, I had no difficulty following those eddies and turns. Do you think of the reader and try to help them along? Or do you think, no, I have to write this the way it comes out and the reader will have to keep up?
Well, I think when I set out on the first draft, that I think of nothing apart from what is the story, who are the characters, what's going to happen in these pages. But by the time I get to the second draft, I am, you know, aware that I want the book to be read. Now, I don't think about catering to readers particularly, and if anyone ever made a request, it would be rudely refused. But, you know, I suppose in the past I've described it a bit as, you know, an actor doesn't perform to be or not to be with their back to the audience. You have to be aware that you want to be read and that you're making something to share. It's not just for the drawer. You want it to be published and you want people to understand it and to take something from it. And so I am aware of, you know, not letting myself get too mithery with all the words. You know, sometimes I read back and I think, what the hell was that? I don't, you know, and then I have to unpick it if I don't know what it meant. You know, obviously nobody else will. So I do think of the reader, but I just don't think of them too much.
Yeah. But, you know, I like the acknowledgement that they must be considered. And as you say, what's the point in doing the big speech from the play with your back to the audience? not a lot of point in that, for sure. That aspect in The Lesser Bohemians, Stephen told his story. And again, don't want to go too much into the story particularly, because that's the joy of that is in the reading, or the pain of it is in the reading, perhaps even. He tells it as a kind of monologue, very theatrical type of thing to do. Here he is showing this film to Eily and his daughter Grace, and obviously, you know, you're doing a story, you're telling a story in a book, it is all about show, don't tell. What is the motivating factor for him to show a film rather than simply sit them down and tell them another, give them another long monologue?
Well, you know, I think there's an aspect in the book which is about, you know, art, about how art gets made. And this is, you know, he's been an actor all his life, and then he's written this script and now he's directed it and made it. And it's, you know, about how life becomes transformed through the act of making a work, be it a novel or a film or a painting or, you know, writing a concerto, how we transform the kind of the base metal of our life into, hopefully, into gold. And I wanted to explore that with him. And also, I think for him, the story that he tells within it is very difficult, is very painful. And in, for him personally as a character, it's a kind of reckoning with that past, of coming to some kind of understanding, of trying to make peace with the man that he once was, in both good ways and destructive ways. And it's important that he shares this with his daughter, that she sees his side of that story, because she's always known it from her mother's side. And he doesn't let himself off the hook. He's very self-condemnatory. But also, it's about Eily, how he and Eily share a creative relationship as well as, you know, romantic, sexual relationship, that they also have a creative connection. And, you know, he asks her opinion. He wants to know what she thinks. And she kind of helps him and guides him, and is, you know, it's a very rich relationship as a result.
Also, you've been, I think, was it during the writing, perhaps, of The City Changes Its Face that you, or perhaps afterwards, I'm not quite sure, you can give me the timeline, where you wrote and directed your own short film, a very short film about longing, which was, I think, shown in 2023. Did that feed into the writing of Stephen's script in any way in this novel?
Well, you know, I think that the two things were quite symbiotic. I knew when I was about to make the film that I hadn't written Stephen's film yet, but I knew that the film was going to feature. I didn't know how heavily it would feature. So, you know, there was a little part of it like, yes, I want to make the film, but also I want to learn how to make a film so that I can write the film in a kind of very organic way. Mm. So, they kind of fed off each other. And I think then because I had made the film, I was able to make more of that section than perhaps I would have without knowing how it was done.
Yeah, and it is interesting the way it's done in that, yes, it is the film script per se, but we also see and hear Eileen's reactions, kind of inner thoughts to what she's looking at. She's kind of telling us the script in some ways of Stephen's film as she's watching it. And that allowing her to have that inner voice and to hear those comments, I thought was a real coup de grace in some ways.
I mean, it was quite tricky because it's sort of set out as a film script, but it's not actually a script. Mm. So when you're reading it, it is novelistic. It's not it's not set out with dialogue. It's you see the film through Eileen's eyes, and as she's experiencing it, and then, you know, trying to intersperse that with her own reaction to it and her awareness of Grace's reaction, or of Stephen's reaction, the moments where he cringes at the things his daughter is about to see, or when she's upset by things that she's seen. It was, you know, I mean, technically quite fiddly.
To do that. And I suppose just for the sake of the listener who is wondering, you know, what is in the film? Essentially, he has had awful things happen in his life, which have caused him, but are part of the reason why he does awful things himself later on. Mm. So, as you say, you don't let him off the hook, or he doesn't let himself off the hook in the writing of it either. You mentioned about that idea of making art as a way of Stephen and Eileen, their creative and their intimate relationship, making art is all part of that. Is writing a novel, what does that do for you, the making of that art, in terms of explaining things to yourself about the stories you're telling?
Oh, well, you know, I think it's less about art and more about sanity for me when it comes to writing. I don't really think about making art. I think, how do I get this thing that's inside of me out onto the page and therefore gain some relief from the pressure to do that? It's entirely kind of selfish and slightly crazed process.
And I mean, and there are one of the things about A Girl Is a Half-Formed Thing, it took a while for it to be published, and one publisher did offer you you can publish this, but let's reassess it as a memoir. There are obviously large aspects of your own life. You were an actor, you're now a writer, you moved to London, all of those things that some of them mirrored in Eileen's life as well. How quickly does it move away from a simple, here are things that happened to me, into something totally different?
I think quite early on. I mean, the setting for Les Bohemians was really important because I really wanted to recreate that London that I had known, you know, when I was a teenager and moved there. And then obviously it has to, when the city changes its face, comes along, it has to be the same place, but time has moved on. And I think there are, of course, some things that are absolutely personal to me, like the time and place. But it's not memoir, and it's not autofiction. Yeah. It's most definitely fiction, but it is threaded through with things. And, you know, both books are to a large extent about love, the difficulties and the wonders of it. And I felt throughout both books that I threaded lots of personal secret things that I love into those books, because that felt like a way to transmit that feeling. And so in that way, in a way that the reader would not necessarily notice or pick up on or consider to be important, there is a lot of personal detail in there.
But your own little secrets in places, and they can stay, they can stay that way. Just wanted to finish up finally by mentioning Edna O'Brien, obviously a great hero of yours. In fact, you wrote the foreword, I think, to a recent republication, a reissue of The Country Girls. Obviously, her recent death was a great loss to Irish literature. I think particularly in the way you write about intimacy, which is once again in this in The City Changes Its Face. You've often credited what Edna O'Brien did in her day, opened up the door, I think, if I'm not putting words into your mouth, for you to write or to have the possibility of writing in the way you wrote. There was talk about a screen version of The Country Girls, which kind of went awry during COVID. Any chance that that might come back? I know Edna O'Brien had given you notes on that initial script.
Yeah, I wish it would. I think it just got stuck in the bottleneck. I don't know. I would love to work on it again. And I had such a wonderful time working on it with her. Slightly terrifying, of course, waiting for her notes, which would never miss you and hit the ball. But I mean, I think they would be, you know, they're a beautiful set of books and they would make wonderful television series. So who knows? I live in hope.
Yeah, well, I think we all do. It would be great to see, because that interaction between you and her, I'm sure, would have been interesting. I know that you're involved in an adaptation of Anna Lindsay's Girl in the Dark for Seesaw Films, and also you've written a screenplay for The Lesser Bohemians, Michael Fassbender's production company. Have that in tow. Anything in movement and on movement on any of those fronts that we might see coming to the screen?
Slow forward movement on all fronts, but nothing coming anytime soon. I'm afraid I'm searching for mad millionaires who are going to pick up where the BBC got a little bit freaked out by the Lesser Bohemians.
There might be sane millionaires who'll do the same thing for you. So
if possible, that would be even better.
We'll send out a call to both, and I think we might hear more from Stephen and Eily. I have a funny feeling. Eimear, lovely to speak with you as always. Congratulations on the novel, and thanks for speaking with us this evening.
Thank you.
Eimear McBride there, speaking to us about her latest novel, The City Changes Its Face, which is published by Faber. The Ghosts of Rome by Joseph O'Connor is the second in a trilogy which takes us back to that city. During the Nazi occupation in the early 1940s, My Father's House was the first installment. It told the story of Monsignor Hugh O'Flaherty, the real-life Kerry priest who led a clandestine escape line network that saved the lives of countless Allied prisoners of war and Jews. The Ghosts of Rome is set a year later, that's the new book. This time it focuses on Contessa Giovanni Landini and her husband, another member of the resistance, or the choir as they are called, who draws the unwelcome attention of Gestapo chief Paul Hauptmann. Richard Aldous has been reading The Ghosts of Rome for us. He joins me on the line now. Richard, the first novel was such a big success, My Father's House, for Joseph O'Connor. We have lots of the same characters here. We're in the same situation in Nazi-occupied Rome, or the Vatican to be precise. But the focus has shifted away from Hugh O'Flaherty, the priest, to other members of the choir, the name that they give to the resistance group.
Thanks, Sean. Yeah, we had a bit of Second World War technology there, I think. It's as you say, the first book was a fantastic success, and all of these characters were set up in the first novel. This time we do move to the Contessa, who's this kind of Italian aristocratic figure, and the relationship that she has, any kind of love affair, but her antagonistic relationship with Paul Hauptmann, the German chief of police, is one of the themes that runs all the way through this book. It's worth pointing out that the opera Tosca, which has a similar kind of relationship, is something that Joseph O'Connor references throughout. So there are a lot of operatic notes along the way.
Yeah, I mean, music is a hugely important part of this book, as it was in My Father's House, the music of Rome, and it's a choir that sings a lot of sacred music. But jazz plays a role in the novel as well.
That's right, because we have Americans in this novel. That two of the main feature two of the main characters are escaping American military figures, and so yeah, that does play its part. So as you say, music all the way through is kind of something that is constantly referenced.
One of the important aspects of what Joseph O'Connor, I think, has done with these books, these people, who many of them were real-life people, there are fictional aspects or fictionalised aspects to some of the characters as well. They never spoke, they didn't speak a lot about their experiences. But he has researched, O'Connor has researched this deeply and still manages to give us the basis of fact, but fiction mixed in with it. How does he manage that balance, Richard?
He manages it very cleverly, actually, because like a genuinely expert writer of historical fiction, he uses the history, but he's not a prisoner of it. So that, you know, as you say, a lot of this is imagined. Hauptmann is a character that is very similar to Herbert Kapler, who was the German police. But for reasons that he wants to expand beyond that, he doesn't use the original name. Monsignor Flaherty, on the other hand, it does feature as a character. So I think there's a kind of an honesty in the book that says, look, a lot of this is imagined, but I'm kind of giving you a clear sign of where this is rooted in history. He's also very clever because the majority of the narrative is set, as you said, in 1944. But then we suddenly step out of the narrative and you get these oral histories and recollections and diaries and memoirs and so on from the post-war period. So as a reader, you think that you're kind of trundling along quite happily, and then he'll just very cleverly knock you off kilter slightly in ways that I think really help the power of the story.
And another that's important to point out for Irish listeners in particular, Delia Carney, as she is in the book, but Delia Murphy, the singer, is part of this. She was wife of the ambassador to the Vatican. There was a lot at stake here in terms of Ireland's neutrality, but also within this book, the Gestapo breathing down their neck, the necks of the choir. What kind of tension does that add to the storytelling, Richard?
I mean, it is tremendously tense. There's one brilliant scene, actually, where one of the characters, a reporter, meets somebody who is escaping and gives advice and says, you have to do nothing. You have to look calm. You mustn't run. You must walk. It's 90 seconds away from freedom. And we follow that walk almost precisely to the second in the writing as we move across. I mean, it's an absolutely unbearable moment. But it does give this genuine sense of peril because, as you rightly say, these people quite literally were putting their lives on the line, showing incredible courage.
What do the two new American soldiers, the characters of Weldrick and Miles, obviously that jazz element is part of it, but what do they bring to the story? What do they add to it? Are they totally fictionalized, or do you know that?
I don't know whether they're fiction. I think they are fictionalized, but they certainly add a kind of a new type of cynicism in the novel, that they're kind of slightly, to begin with, you know, somewhat skeptical about what's being done. They always want to kind of act kind of earlier and so on. So there's a kind of a sense that they introduce a different kind of dynamic. And there are some absolutely brilliant lines in the book, and one of them relates to this, where one of the British characters says to I think to one of the Americans, where he warns him, he kind of says that, you know, one of the things that I've learned, maybe the only thing, is ever reckon you're in trouble, stay exactly where you are, because the devil has worse, friend, the devil has worse, and he's waiting for you to take it. When I read that line, I mean, that was a devastating line that stayed with me in the few weeks since I read the novel. But it speaks to what we were saying there, this kind of sense of patience that they've experienced, and coming up against these two American characters who kind of sometimes want to act in a much more impetuous kind of way.
Yeah, stand still. It might be safer to stay where you are. Absolutely. Is the advice, and almost certainly during wartime. I think that's possibly not bad advice from my huge experience of wartime, obviously. Does this work as a standalone novel, The Ghosts of Rome? Obviously, it's always going to have help. It's going to help if you've read My Father's House. But does Joseph O'Connor bring us through it for those who might be coming to the trilogy? I think it might be a trilogy on the way. Who might be coming to this as a second book? Does he bring us through it enough that you don't need to go back to the previous one?
I think you could, because actually he does a very neat trick right at the very beginning, that there's a memo from Hauptmann that actually runs us through the state of play and all of the characters. It's a very clever device. So you could just start here. On the other hand, you know, the first book was terrific as well. So in some ways you might want to start there. It's out in paperback now, and then move on to the second.
A recommendation from you on this one, Richard?
Oh, 100%. And I was very struck when I was reading as well that there is a kind of a sense this fits into a golden age of Irish literary fiction. There are so many, but Banville, Colm Tobin, John Boyne, Sally, I mean, there's so much of it. And this absolutely is writing at the top of his game.
That's great to hear. Richard Aldous speaking to us about Joseph O'Connor's The Ghosts of Rome, which is published by Harvard Secker.